Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's your girl, Kads Adar, and you're listening to the Digital Sisterhood Podcast. This week's episode is going to be a little different, you guys. It's going to be a little different. It's going to be a lot more special. This week's guest is, her name is Johara Lula, and she talks about a very important topic and a very important, and not just an important story, but a beautiful story. But this week, I'm not going to be narrating this story. Her sister will be. And you know who sister? Do you know who her sister is? It's Muna. Muna Productions, our executive producer on the Digital Sisterhood Podcast. Guys, honestly, this was basically the sisterly duo that we didn't know we needed, but we got. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. So I'm excited to listen to you guys. You're going to hear me regardless because I did do the interview, but I'm excited to hear it because I'm not going to hear the narrations until the day of. So enjoy, and I'll see you guys, inshallah, next week.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is Muna Sheikh Omar. Before I start, I want to give a trigger warning. This episode talks about suicide and suicide ideation. So if you are not ready to hear any of that, you can take a break on this one. I want to start by saying that I'm actually honored to be able to be share the story with you. There was a meme on Instagram that basically summarized my experience as a kid. It said, I never thought my siblings had an actual life. They were just side characters to my story. And I feel like being an older sibling, that's something I completely understand. So when I say I don't remember much of Johara growing up, it's because I was really obviously busy living my main character life. But if I was to describe Johara growing up, she was this tiny kid with tiny, not in height, but like super skinny. And she always had a big personality. She was the type of kid that, you know, would have like a photo shoot session with you and like be posing on the wall. And she was just sassy, you know, spicy personality. And I remember we always considered her the dramatic person in the family because she would always say things that were so out of pocket. Some of her phrases that we coined were like, everybody hates me. Or one time she was like, when I grow up, I want to be a waiter. It was always something that would make the family, like everybody start laughing and soon become like a family joke. I remember her as the mood maker. But she was also the one who always had this weird health stuff going on. We never knew what was going on with her. She would sometimes just faint out of nowhere. She would have blackouts. Whenever we were walking, sometimes she would need help. We just knew her as the weaker kid. One time, like whenever we would go out on the bus, and it was especially on windy days, we had to literally hold her down, otherwise she would be blown away by the wind. I honestly saw her one time, her backpack almost took her out. And that was just accepted norms in our family. Everybody knew she was just a little bit weaker, you know, maybe needed some vitamin D. And although in hindsight, I remember these things kind of scared my mom, like now thinking about it as an adult, my mom always had this way of, you know, shifting perspectives. She would reframe certain things that happened to us and make it so that it wasn't like a harsh reality.
I recall, like, when we used to come ride, like, when we used to go on the bus, like, they'd start chanting, like, chocolate, 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 like, together. And I remember not knowing why. Like, it was like I didn't clock that they were trying to make fun of our skin. In my head, I was just processing that when we come on the bus, they start chanting this.
Oh my God.
And then
so
I
literally like chocolate, chocolate, literally on the bus.
Literally. And I'm like, I remember asking my mom, I'm like, oh, this is happening. What is like, like, I don't know why they do that. And my mom was like, they're cheering you on. So smile like, and then so here you have like, people that are like, you know, pointing out what, like our skin color. The intent of that is to make you feel ashamed of your skin complexion. But I was standing there, like, so I started smiling, like, as I go on the bus. So it took away the effect of that, degradation, I guess, that they were attempting
to
have.
That's funny. You know that your mom, instead of your mom telling you they're making fun of your skin, just ignore them. She told you they're celebrating your skin. Smile at them. Yo, that is actually, that is the coolest thing. If you had to lie to your kid, a good lie looks like that.
And also, when you're getting, like, when people try to put you down, it's kind of not effective if you're not reactive to it. So
exactly.
It takes away their gratification of it. So I feel like it was a very effective way to shut it down.
The other thing that was unique about the way our mom kind of raised us was that we moved around a lot. And Jada was born in the United States. However, my mom wanted us to be in a Muslim country, so we moved to Syria. And then after that, we moved to Emirat. And even while we were living in those countries, we were moving almost every year. We lived in a different house. And so that kind of like nomadic lifestyle allowed us to be able to have an adaptable personality to environmental changes around us. And it kind of helped us grow in a unique perspective than someone who was, who grew up with the same people, the same neighborhood, in the same school.
And with moving every year in general, like that kind of change externally, I feel like in a way it grounded me to myself rather than feeling like I was disconnected with everything else. Everything else around me used to change, like my house changed, my schools changed, the people I talked to changed. And in a way, I feel like it redirected me and familiarized me with whatever, what the constant in my life was, which was me and Allah, like that connection with Allah that I had. So that's the benefit that I came to love about the way my mom raised us.
So when Johara was about to start fourth grade, my mom tells us that we are leaving Shariqa and we're going to be moving to where my dad was at the time, which is Minneapolis, Minnesota, United States. And whereas some kids may be scared to move to a new place, we were basically experts at that point. Luckily for us, Minneapolis, Minnesota is also known as like Little Mogadishu. So even though we were going to a new country, we were still surrounded by Somalis. And our entire school was predominantly Somali, which made it easier for us to be able to learn the language quickly. Within the first year, Johara was able to be speaking fluently. But as we all know, when it comes to fourth grade and like middle school in general, there's a signature experience that almost everyone goes through, and it's called bullying.
I feel like when I first attended school in America, there was only things, there were specific things I was paying attention to, like being autistic, but diagnosed as an adult, the bullying aspects of school. When I came to realize these things were bullying, were way past, when I was in college, reflecting back on my experiences, like I didn't really understand like certain things that people would do to make you feel bad about yourself, like particularly middle school. Just I feel like middle school, people are a little, even like there's people that I'm friends with like now, but it's funny because middle school, I feel like people are really a little malicious, like some people that you go to school with. I was just more confused about the things that would happen when I say certain things, and I was just kind of like processing things as like, this happened, this person said this, not as like, this is what they think of me or like, this is how they see me. I was like very disconnected with how I was being perceived. I was very much like, oh, I'm in a school. Hey, you're the nice people. Oh, I'm going to learn the language. Like, talk to people. Even, like, I feel like people that were rude to me, I would still ask them for, like, questions. Like,
basically, the distincting factor was that, like, while somebody would have picked up social norms and recognized, oh, these people don't like you.
Yeah.
Maybe not talk to them. Maybe not share a pencil. So you instead would be confused as to why they said that.
Yeah.
And I think in result might look like kind of like an airhead, but in reality, yeah, you just weren't connecting what they were trying to express in their words. And then you would just turn and ignore, and then again, hang out with them or ask them a question or
treat as if it didn't happen. I would engage with them like
yeah,
they weren't like trying to be exclusive or trying to like bully me. the thing that helped is, like, I was just like, yet again, I'm not really reactive to those comments. So, like, usually where somebody, like, if somebody tells you, oh, your teeth, you have two big front teeth, or your teeth are crooked, like, somebody might go cry about it. Mm-hmm. But then for me, it was like, this person is describing my teeth. And then so I described how her teeth looked like to her. Yeah. And it's interesting because I was like I was just very disconnected with that. Oh, this is what they think of me when they're saying that. It was just kind of like, oh, this person said these things. Okay.
So being neurodivergent, Johara just took her experiences as they are. She didn't really read into what was the reason that someone would be doing a certain action. It just was an experience. So if someone threw away all her stuff in the trash, it was just like, okay, they threw all of my stuff away in the trash. It's not about, oh, what do they mean by this? So it was very easy for her to carry on with her life when that happened. But there was a different type of bullying that was direct. It didn't hide behind implied things. It was words. Jara talks about a time when she was sitting in class. The teacher starts assigning people into groups, and she gets assigned into a group with two other girls. And one of the girls turns to the other girl and says, I don't want to be partners with her. She's dumb.
And it was explicit way of saying, like, I don't want to work with you. And so, like, it was a very verbal way of, like, she communicated directly that she didn't not only wanted to work with me, but also how she thought of, how she perceived my intellect. And so that's the first time where I was like, am I, because I didn't, at that time, like, by middle school, like, I had finished the Quran, like, and I used to do well in school. So I, like, I didn't perceive myself as that. Like, I had other people in my life that perceived me otherwise, right? And so because I thought of myself as, like, not dumb, I was, like, that emotionally hurt. And I remember writing to the teacher, like, about it, like, in those, them teachers that have the extra boxes, they're like, right in there, if there's anything you can't tell me directly. What I wanted was to, like, at that time, I wrote it so that it's like, oh, this person doesn't want me to be in their group. And, like, you know, I could, like, work in another group or by myself.
Wow. So you weren't even telling her to tell her how upset you were, telling her, can you move me?
Yeah. So that I am removed from this, discomforting this person. Because I felt in a way, like, I was doing harm. And I remember going home that day and thinking about it. And, like, you know, I was not emotionally expressive. Like, you won't see, like, me crying. I look more nonchalant when I was younger. And, like, especially with my facial expressions. And when things like this happen, it's like half the time I'm thinking about it. I have to go process it the rest of the day and sit there like, oh, my God. You know, they called me dumb. Am I dumb? And then thinking of myself as dumb, like thinking they thought of me as dumb while I thought otherwise was painful. And so when I was like, you know what, everyone can't be smart, like, you know, and what, I'm dumb, and yeah, and what about it? And I feel like, I almost feel like that is the origin of me, like, one of my coping mechanisms of dealing with, like, negative comments and, like getting through school at that time is like, you know what, and what's wrong about it? I'm ugly. Okay, I'm ugly. And when I perceived myself in those negative traits, like, I feel like others perceiving me that way was just informative rather than, like, degrading. Does that make sense?
Also, so for you, it was like intel.
It was like, okay, it's like somebody saying you're wearing a black shirt. At that time, I feel like the pain that comes from, like, hearing those things, it went away when I thought, like, when I just internalized it, when I was like, yeah, okay, I am that.
So Johara joined the boat of a very common coping mechanism people have, which is, if I hurt myself first, somebody else saying it to me doesn't hurt as much. So I would take a picture of her or something, and it was like, ugh, I hate my mouth. I hate myself. She would say, I hate my mouth. I hate my teeth. I hate looking at myself. I'm so ugly, you know? And it's things that just came out naturally, I guess. It always used to jar me and like just be like, what do you mean you look ugly, or what do you mean, like, why, how do you casually just accept these things about yourself? Like, I was like, I always used to be like, the world is gonna bully you, why bully yourself? But actually it was a form of protecting herself. And you know that phrase that Johar always used to say, everybody hates me? My mom used to always respond with an equally ridiculous statement, sarcastically. And she'd say, who loved you anyways? The sad thing is that Johar took that literally.
I feel like that's, when I was younger, I rid myself of that expectation because of how I processed those words, even though that's not how it was intended. Like, you know, I was like, everybody hates me. Everybody, yeah. When I say everybody hates me, I was like, oh, look what Jalo, you know.
No, and your mom was being sarcastic.
My mom was being sarcastic.
But you took it as like real. Like, oh,
Very literal.
Because for you, it was like a questioning hanging in the room. You're like, does people like, I think it might have been like, you're like, okay, that makes sense for all of this experience.
Yes. You know what I mean? It was like, oh,
that's why I wasn't being treated so nicely and why I was experiencing this and that.
Like,
and
it was like the explanation. Like, and it was like, for me, it's like, dang, okay, I was looking at it wrong. Like, I know, but Skawala, like, I'm out of pocket for it. Like, it was funny because it was like, I was like self-reprimanding for expecting that, like, and so, but that's just like, when I look at it overall, like, I feel like it manifested throughout,
yeah, how well, I saw yourself and
and how it affected my self-image and, yeah, like, and what kind of relationships I built. They don't tell you when you're younger, oh yeah, if you experience this and this and this, should alarm you, like, this thing shouldn't happen. The other thing I dealt with was chronic pain for like, and like having health issues and like having other health things that were undiagnosed that were just like my day-to-day, like dealing with fatigue, like all these other things that was just in the background.
I want you, when you're listening to the story, just to kind of notice how casually Johara talks about pain, and that's something that's like a common thread when it comes to her narrating her story about her pain. It's like, my sister says some of the most, like, you know, crazy things, in the sense of like, it's a big deal, but she says it in like a regular way because she's been experiencing it for so long. And the thing is, when you say it in a dramatic way, people end up chastising you, and that's what she ended up experiencing throughout her childhood. People showed her how they treat people who show their pain.
The experiences that I had that made me hide it, like my, like all the things that I was experiencing, at least my health and stuff, were particularly related to the reactions that I initially had when I shared, when I was expressive about it. So like, when I experienced, like if I couldn't stand for long periods of time, I was having back pain and stuff. How could you have back pain? Go, like, you're a young girl. Like, you're fine. Kaistag, like, go get this. Or, like, if I took a chair in the masjid to, like, if there was Taraweeh or prayer or something like that, and I wanted to sit on a chair, it'd be like, aha. Like, you know, those reactions.
Being overdramatic.
Like,
yeah.
They don't think they're saying something detrimental long term, but, like, it's just not in their image of what, like, somebody, like, even like children, like people don't attribute sick to them. Like they, like, even though there's a lot of children that grow up with like long-term health conditions that they have to manage from a young age.
But if it's not visible, you're not sick.
Exactly. If it's not visible, it's not sick. Also, there's another, I feel like, a concept of like, if you are not like incapacitated by it, then it's not serious. Here's the literal statement, the statement that I took quite literally. Everybody, everyone goes through this. Like, this is something that we've been through. Everyone goes through this. So I literally internalized that I thought everyone was going through the same level of pain that I was experiencing. And I was just being like, weak about it. I thought, oh, I just need to stop. Like, I need to stop acting up. I started telling myself the things that people would say in reaction to me. Like, which is, oh, Allah. Like, she's being dramatic. Oh, she's doing this for attention. So whenever I experienced pain and stuff and it was becoming more visible, I'm like, stop this. Like, I would try to stop myself from crying. And then, like, I think I repressed a lot more and, like, told myself, oh, don't burden people with yourself. Like, well, Diptona, like, and, like, you're, you know, your parents are already working hard and doing a lot for you. Like, don't add this on top of everything. And, you know, be quiet about it. Because everybody else is doing that, so why can't you? Is how I
wow.
would, like, gaslight myself in a...
The habit of hiding her pain and gaslighting herself continued for years. Johara was like a Oscar-worthy performance at hiding what was going on with her. In our family, she was like the one that everybody, she took care of everybody. She would always have a lot of friends, you know. So you would never think about the fact that she may be in pain. It was so unfathomable for me, you know, that someone who was so out there taking care of everybody would be in pain. Then sophomore year of college came. My mother was gone to Somalia with my younger siblings. It was just me, my sister, and my dad in the house. And one night she woke me up in the middle of the night. I think it may have been like 3 a.m., 2 a.m. And she says to me, Muna, could we go to the ER? In the most casual tone. I couldn't tell if she was joking or for real. She was like, yeah, I have a headache. And I couldn't sleep all night. This girl was the queen of, like, downplaying what was going on with her. She said it was a headache, but it was a migraine. Imagine being in pain to the point where you think, like, regular pain medication is not doing me anything. I have to go to the ER. And for me, it was the first time that I actually got to glimpse some of the pain that she's been living with. I remember one time I asked her, are you okay? Are you in any pain? And she says to me, casually, she says, when I'm always in pain, it's just sometimes it's more bearable than others. Like, majority of times, like, background pain playing. And I was like, Are you talking about your pain? Like, it's some background music? Like, sometimes it's forefront, sometimes it's in the back. Like, we're talking about pain. And whenever we would go to hospitals, it was so annoying because a lot of times healthcare is about how the doctor perceives you or how important they think your symptoms are. Or a lot of times you have to self-report what's going on with you. And it's like they constantly put you in a loop. So you go to the ER. The ER doctor says, oh, go see your primary doctor. You go see the primary doctor. And sometimes even before you get to your primary doctor, it'd be a couple months. The primary doctor says you have to go see a specialist. The specialist is three to 2 months out appointments. And through all this time, you are in pain. And so when we would be sitting there, Johara would be like, yeah, my pain is, 11 out of 10. And I'm just, you know, she's saying it in the most calmest tone. And she says, you know, I want to take my head and I want to bang it against the wall. That would give me relief. She was so good at hiding. But this time it was too much. Her body couldn't do it anymore.
I didn't understand what was going on with my body and why it was that bad myself. Like, I was more trying to ignore it and pretend it's not there and, like, manage it secretly. It's like pretending like I'm fine was my anthem. And so with my sister, it was like I just knew what the things that helped me with, like feel better. And so I didn't have to explain to her. It didn't have to make sense for her in order for her to do it for me. And I was so used to just diluting on, like, anything that I was experiencing, I would talk about it very lightly. So somehow when I'm sometimes in the clinic, I'm like, yeah, I'm good. Or I leave the office and I remember the thing that I was wanted, that I came in for. I'm going to tell you, long story short, the first season of my crash was that. And in that crash, I only addressed like the health, the physical health crisis, nothing else. Even though I knew there's a lot of emotional pain that I was grieving and that I was experiencing, like I was processing, but I only dealt with just the physical. I was very focused on like I genuinely could not think past, like I was just pain. But pain, I have to be in the classroom and still take my classes. Alhamdulillah, like I had ease with like a specific medication that I got at the time, like, and that worked finally. And also I had like somebody else give me advice about like, hey, you know, basically her, when she got her wisdom removed, that it like the tooth pain that she had like was contributing to triggering her migraines. And when she got it removed, like she saw like a significant decrease in the number of like episodes she had. And so I was like, you know what? Let's go check it out. The funniest thing is though, when I first went to the emergency, I told him like, I also oftentimes like I have this specific tooth pain that also happens like prior and throughout when I'm having my migraine episodes. He told me that has nothing to do with your teeth.
Alhamdulillah, Johara listened to her friend rather than that ER doctor. And she was able to see a significant decrease in her migraine episodes. And then came the time when her plan that she's been working on for 2 years finally came to fruition, which was her great escape to South Korea. If you are a Somali, or if you grew up with strict parents, the idea, the simple idea of studying abroad is hilarious. My mom was the definition of a strict parent. But she didn't even let us have friends, you know. It was like, I remember the first time that I told my mom I was going to hang out with friends, she came with me. It was weird. It was awkward. She sat in the corner of a restaurant. I was like, and this was my high school. I think end of the high school, like we went out to eat. And so when I tell you my mom is very overprotective, she's very overprotective. And Johara always used to surprise me because she was brave like that. She would dare to do the impossible. She would dare to go abroad and travel for 4 months by herself. And luckily, my mom was gone to Somalia, so she didn't have to do it face to face.
I knew from when I started college, it's funny because I told my mom then, I was like, Mom, I'm going to study abroad
junior year. So you were preparing her for months, maybe years.
From first year.
Because that's the thing, right? With religious households, you can't break it to them all at once. It's never going to fly. It's something you got to continue to repetitions. Well, I repetitions is what's going to save you. So it's like,
you got to slowly.
I'm leaving Hoya. I'm going here, Mom and Dad. This is where I'm going. It's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so you were doing that for years because you knew it was going to come.
But my mom was so against it. Like, I think, like, initially, like, oh, my God. When I first brought it up, she said, we don't do that. We don't do that. I was like, I need to do it for my major. And she said, change your major.
Oh, wow. As your mom was not having it.
In every step, like, you know how they say mother's intuition? When I first applied, my mom that day, she was on the phone talking to me. She was in Somalia still. And Muna happened to be traveling abroad for the first time. And my mom was like, Allah, if I was there, I would have stopped her. I would have confiscated her passport. And then she's saying this about Muna. And Muna, because she knows Muna was leaving, right? While we're having that discussion, she's like, I have a feeling, Aliga, that you're going to, I'm also going to say the same thing. And you're going to call me, oh, yeah, I'm in Korea. That was the day I submitted my application. Like,
oh,
deposit.
My God. Did she make that comment to you?
She made that comment the day I submitted the application. And I was like,
her soul knew. Her soul
the
knew
way
the
I just like, So then closer to the time this is like end of January. Closer to the time I had to leave, my mom, like, she called me about it. And then, and she was like, did you cancel it? She was like, I just have a feeling. Ismail was my younger brother. It was joking around about you probably buying your ticket.
Oh no.
Wallahi, that was the day I bought the ticket.
Oh no.
Call it, Ishak. The day I bought the ticket was
my God.
The day my mom makes that. I don't know how, like, I'm literally thinking, bro,
You must have been shaking. You were like sweating. Like, what the heck? What is going on?
I was like, there's no way she doesn't know. Like, by the time I told her, like, it was a month in advance. And I was like, it's like, I told her it's something like I have to do. Like, there's no way I can back out of it. Because the reality was like, the school already had paid like the tuition. And so like, it's not like I would not attend school for the semester. And to give you like, my mom, she was like, just don't go to school that semester.
Oh my, wallah, your mom wasn't joking. She was very serious. She was very serious.
And even like closer to the date, my dad ended up traveling for like a week. So like,
so he wasn't there either.
He was also out of town that time. I'm packing casually. Like, mm-hmm. I'm getting ready. Like
you're putting your socks, you're putting your shoes in the suitcase.
Yeah, and the other aspect is like, I already had told my grandma like she knew everything. So like, mm-hmm. except she knew everything except the time that I was leaving. Mm-hmm. I thought my dad was out, so then he ended up coming back a little earlier, and mm-hmm. he came that Sunday, and I leave on Wednesday, so he came back Sunday.
Oh no!
And then I wake up, and then my dad asked me, "When are you leaving?" And I don't know. You know when you wake up, you're just like your brain is not really fully clocked back in, telling you like, this is federal information, do not share this information. I was like, Wednesday. Allah. And then I just hear my mom screaming from the phone, Wakushig, I told you this.
Oh no.
So then I kind of exposed myself in that way. And so my dad is like more chill and laid back. He's like, I thought we talked about it. I thought you're not gonna go. And I'm like, we did talk about it. It wasn't a discussion. It was like, you shouldn't go, like, period. And so my dad sent me to go, like, bring my stuff back. Because I told him I had, like, my documents and stuff at school. Yeah, that's when I left.
When Johanna says she left, she means she, like, ran away. Basically, she left to a friend's house and decided to stay there until Wednesday when she could get on the plane safely. But her stuff was back at home. So the person who became the smuggler was me. I was the only sibling here. And to be honest, a lot of times I didn't participate. Well, actually, I did. But in order to keep my own sanity, I just pretended like I didn't know anything to my family. I was like, I don't know where she went. And my dad would come to me and be like, where's your sister? What's going on? I haven't seen her in 2 days. I was like, honestly, I don't know. I keep calling her. She's not answering me. It was a performance. And I think what mattered most to me was, after seeing her in so much pain, I wanted her to have that break in Korea. She's been looking forward to it for so long. And so I was down, whatever it took to get her out. Luckily, it was my dad that's here, who's much more chill. If it was my mom, she would be driving around the Twin Cities looking for her, probably filling out a police report, going like, my daughter is missing. Somebody find her. And the scariest thing was, I overheard my mom and my dad talking, and my mom said she was coming back on Wednesday, the day that Johara was going to be leaving. We didn't know the time. She said she's coming 1 o'clock. I didn't know if it was 1 a.m. or 1 p.m. So I tell Johara this, and I'm like, bruh, you better be incognito at the airport. So luckily, my mom ended up landing at 1 p.m. My sister traveled that day at 6 a.m. And my mom, at first, although she was completely angry against it. Once Johara talked to her, she kind of calmed down and she started asking her about the classes she's taking there. And it was like, there's nothing she could do about it anymore.
And Korea was so good for you, wasn't it?
Oh, it really was. And I think it was the break that I needed from at least stressors in terms of, like, it was like a chill version of college. Like, I was just taking classes that I liked. I was taking evening classes, electives, you know. I was really vacationing, basically full-time, studying part-time. And so it was a really good break from everything. And I think it was like a good self-reflection time, because it was the first time where I got to have really, like, full autonomy and, like, without thinking about how others were going to perceive me in, like, choosing the clothes that I wear and how I cover and veil, and, like, even praying is, like, really up to you. And so in a way I was really challenged, because I was so dependent on the environment, like, kind of making it autopilot. Almost like everybody's it's prayer time in the house, like, you know, you just join. And I went to an Islamic school in high school, and so, like, there's always a lot of things that made it, like, convenient. I had different things that made it, like, that was made Deen a part of the day-to-day. And so for the first time it was a big challenge on my end, and I struggled a lot. And at the same time, I feel like I grew connected to Allah a lot more at that time. And I feel like it was significant, because coming back, I came back to the environment that I was in before. And at the same time, is like, even when I was in Korea, like, I got down all, like, my health stuff, but I knew I was still having, like, different health challenges that I didn't have, like, I haven't had diagnosed or had treatment for. I just knew this is what I experience on the day-to-day. And so when I came back, I knew, I was like, okay, I have health insurance. Like, let me continue. And so that's what I pursued, like, to, like, go to the physician and, like, tell them my symptoms and stuff, so that they can figure out what else was going on, right? Particularly during that time, I switched back to I went from living by myself to living in a large family household again. Like, everybody's on a schedule, and, like, everyone was adapted to their own, to each other's schedule, but it felt like mine was, like, not on everybody else's.
So being in Korea for 4 months and a half, Johara was able to build a routine that consisted of her living on campus. She was able to get things done, and routine was very, very important to her.
The thing is, like, knowing, like, about my, like, being autistic and having ADHD is something, and, like, generally being neurodivergent is something I found the language for in the past year, versus, like, so at the time I was just struggling, and I was just thinking something's wrong with me. Like, I don't know why I'm struggling with the basic stuff, like, oh, I didn't eat all day, or, like, things that, just because I didn't have a routine around them, or, like the things that, like, yeah, basically, if there wasn't, like, consistency, or, like, there was changes, I would just, like, skip the routine related to that. I was always figuring out different coping stuff to help me figure out, like, how to do the things that I want to do, but I didn't know why I needed to have additional coping things, if that makes sense.
So Johara began to write her own playbook to be able to survive and help herself get to the goals that she wanted to do. One of the things my mom always used to comment on was the fact that Johara, whenever she was doing something, she always used to have somebody on the phone with her, like, almost 24/7. It was kind of odd for my mom. But for Johara and her ADHD, which was undiagnosed at the time, having somebody there helped her focus on the task. And she would write herself note cards, post-it notes. She would help herself in different ways to be able to achieve what she wanted to achieve. There was another side that Johara wasn't dealing with. If you think about a balloon that somebody is blowing into, and as they blow and blow and blow, there comes a moment when that balloon pops and everything that's inside that balloon comes out.
But I was also carrying the heavy self-hatred, load of like me internalizing all these like age 0 to 20 something of hatred directed towards me that I just compiled. Like, I never processed like any of these experiences. I'm just like the baggage that I was carrying around. And I used to like wonder, why is it easier to be hateful towards myself than like be kind? So like,
yeah, and compassionate.
Yeah, like it's yucky. It was like, if I told myself, oh, you're beautiful, I'd be like, no matter how much I knew how I was supposed to feel about myself, like how I actually felt about myself was a lot different. Like when it came to when I started struggling really with my mental health, it was like, oh my God. It's like my brain like brings back everything that was unaddressed. And particularly I've taken note that like I had like right before my period, like I used to be so like the experience I had was like so intense.
Johara got diagnosed with syndrome called PMDD, which is premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which is a severe form of PMS. It can manifest in severe irritability, anxiety, depression, the week or two before your period starts. And in Johara, there was also a symptom of lack of sleep. She couldn't sleep for like sometimes 2, 3, 4 days. But this was at a time where it was undiagnosed. So Johara was having all the symptoms, but didn't know what the cause of it was, or if it's something that other people are experiencing as well. Because this would happen every period cycle, continuously. And so these symptoms, severe depression, severe anxiety, were just part of her daily routine, or monthly routine, I guess. And she went a while without addressing them. But one time, she had a trigger that woke her up to how severe her situation actually went. And I want to give a trigger warning here, in case you missed the one in the beginning. The following conversations we'll talk about suicide, you know, suicide ideation. And so just to give you a warning.
My wake-up call was, so I want to just like narrate it in a way that the day I remembered this day, it was one like my sister's birthday. So mind you, I'm just carrying a baggage of like life experiences, memorized HD. Part of being autistic is like not everybody has like full memory recall, but I think for me personally, my brain just memorized excessive detail. Like I can like recall a lot from my childhood and stuff. But in a way, there was like a segment and all the negative life experiences was just kind of put in an area where I don't think about, but it contributed to how I felt about myself, but I didn't actively think about those unless it was like I was really in a dark head space and my brain is like saying, oh yeah, remember this, oh yeah, remember that. I had an incident in which like I was being like open and vulnerable about asking like a person. They weren't like harmly intending like what they said, but they were just being like, I know. Basically, it was specifically me telling them, oh, something they said hurt my feelings, and they told me like, I don't care. And then I was caught off guard because this is somebody that I didn't have like my guard up with, or like somebody that I didn't overly analyze. It was somebody like I felt like myself around. When I experienced that, it was interesting because it was my first like trauma trigger in a way, and it felt like Pandora box open. Unlocked. I recall when I like, you know, because I also pretended at that time I wasn't affected by those words, but I remember when I went to the bathroom, I was like crying, and I was thinking like, why did you make me think I mattered? Like, like I'm worth something, which is like interesting because then I framed my self-worth like based on who cared versus that I'm inherently have self-worth. Yeah. And I felt like I wasn't in that moment when it first happened. I wasn't seeing the person. I wasn't in the space that I was. I was literally visually experiencing like different times, like different like faces, and like I was just,
you were having a flashback of everyone that told you that you didn't matter.
It was like,
and it came to a boiling like point.
It felt like I could feel everything all at once. You know, all the things I didn't process.
Yeah,
it was just like, and so it put me like, I felt like I was back to scratch, like, you know, all the, like, throughout college, I kind of built some level of sense of self-worth. Yeah. And it felt, like, flat. After that day, like, it was, like, I could, like, I was, everything that I didn't think about was active. Like, I could remember everything. So after that incident, like, I was, you know, I wasn't able to clock that this person, you know, that I never had any doubt about, like, felt this type of way. Oh my God, I could be wrong about everyone. And so it made all social like engagements like feel like I was re-memorizing people from scratch.
Because at this point, what you thought you knew, you didn't know at all.
Exactly.
Because if you couldn't peep the one person and you didn't have your guard up, and she like reopened those like wounds and they came back, and you started to question all your relationships. You're like, oh my God, I didn't.
It was like I wasn't able to, because you know, I
trust your already, own, trust your own opinion.
Yeah, it was like I already didn't know I could, like, you know, I already knew that I could miss like social cues of like people getting upset and things like that.
But so this person though, imagine like you already knew that you were shaking it in those social cues and maybe of your perspective of people. But when you thought you were dead set on one person, you thought you knew them, and then you come to find you didn't. Then what foundation are you standing on?
And it was,
how could you, like, trust yourself again?
So after this incident, like, I didn't know what to do. Like, I'm sitting with like full memory of all like life experiences that I, you know, was just putting to the back and getting over, quote unquote, and just pushing like past. And I recalled the day that I almost, like, that I had an accidental overdose. And
wait, you had an accidental overdose? What do you mean, like, with like prescription drugs?
Yeah. And so there's a lot of insomnia that's induced from like just like the hormonal fluctuations and like that. And so like I was struggling a lot with just already the level of pain I was in. And I recall, I just want to sleep. Even if I took, like, sleeping, like the medicine that I was taking, it was supposed to help you fall asleep, but it was, like, not budging. And it related to, like, it was, like, let me tell, like, 3-4 days that I didn't really
sleep.
So, you're like, exhausted. For me, it's, like, I can't handle, I just want to sleep. But I knew at that time, it's, like, I wasn't very, like, oh my God, careful. Like, I was just like, I'm going to take it until I fall asleep. And if I'm not asleep, like, I'm like, I will take, like, I was taking more. And I remember.
Why were
like,
you, I have a question. Why do you think you were insomniatic at that point? Is it because of stress?
No, it's because of the PMDD and, like, it affected my ability to sleep. You have, like, it affects your appetite. Like, you have an appetite disturbance, sleep disturbance, mood disturbance. Like, I like, it's really a roller coaster from a first person experience. I feel like you go from like functional to like what is what, like just fully like out. Everything, like, even if you're doing everything same, it's like your mood is like zero zone. But I had other different traumatic experiences that happened to me during that time. And so, like,
you were, it was already like, down. You were already down bad.
So you're, it was sad. Like, it added sad.
So
the max.
So basically, that thing, how basically fucked your emotions, and like, and then on top of that, you were sad about the certain event going on. Yeah, like, you're already sad. Like,
barely
holding
processing
on.
And dealing with whatever I was like, and you, like, and experiencing in real life.
And on top of that, you weren't sleeping.
Oh, and so, the thing is, oh my God, there's aspects of like, I was maxed out emotionally, physically. Also, like my physical health was like worse than, it was at its worst as well. Like that's the time it took another dip. But it's interesting because I didn't think about that time period. And when I was dealing with more, like I was experiencing more discrimination, like in school because of like my health things, like, and so like the whole season I had pretty additional things that just exacerbated what already was beyond was
already,
the max.
Yeah, it was already the max. And so you started to
it was just that one day that I was recalling, like there's a difference, like people who have, you know, time, like attempted suicides and stuff, like there's different, some people literally write it out, this like plan things, and there's different things, different ways in which, like, you know, you almost cross over,
yeah,
for like based on the person. But for me, that experience, like I could not sit there and think, no, it's not, it is like out, it's just coincidental. It was very much related to the state of mental and physical well-being I was in. Really, I wasn't thinking through, okay, if I take this much, my body's gonna, or what's the max?
And
I wasn't thinking
die.
About those. I was like, I'm still awake. It was so out of, it's not like something that's in my norm. It was so out of my norm. You're in so much physical and internal pain
that you just want to stop.
Dying feels like you want that to stop.
No, because dying at that point is a relief.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It becomes, mm-hmm. it becomes a relief. And that's, subhanAllah, it's just so, I'm just so sad to hear that, because obviously, like, you, things are bad when dying doesn't seem as scary.
It makes me think of this descriptor that I felt like was very validating at the time when I, you know, like around those times I used to, like, you know, I used to look up memes and stuff, things to help me cope, like at least laugh about it or like feel validated in like what I was dealing with. I think there was one in which like they described it as like people see the person, like see a person standing on like a ledge of a window, and they don't know that the person is, you know, like they'll tell you, don't jump. But you know, that person is looking back to a room that's on fire. And
subhanAllah.
And I felt like, you know, like, yeah. But like at that time, even when you tell somebody, but people care about you, it's like, I feel like that visual shows like,
what is there to go back to when that part,
like,
is on
it's
fire?
Like, it's not like living, yeah. is dying, and dying like at least has an end of something.
Yeah.
And so, I think, you know, alhamdulillah, to have been able to get past that day, because I remember the date, like the morning after, because, you know, it was like, it was really intense that whole night, like, as I was having body shakes and everything. But the morning, like, I remember that day, the day after, all I remember is reading Qul Hu Allah Ahad, and that surah having an effect on me. And like especially the last ayah, that وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدٍ, like, I don't know the English direct, like, I know the meaning, but I can't correctly translate it. But there's none like unto Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And I was thinking that if I have Allah, like, I don't need to know everything. But if I have Allah, like, Allah is enough. And so, like, at that time, I remember asking Allah, like, I don't know what I'm dealing with. I don't know why I'm dealing with this stuff. I don't know what extent, like, why is it affecting me to extent? And I don't know, like, how serious or detrimental it could be to me. But I made the dua that Allah figures out, like, helps me figure out and gets me to the means in which I get better and have ease. And that was, like, something that I recall because I felt so helpless at that time.
To this day, after Johara told me that incident that happened of her accidental overdose, it scares me because it makes me realize how fragile we can be, you know, and how fragile life is. And it kind of woke me up to check in on her more and to not see her as, you know, this basically this other individual who's just a side character in my life. I think it's easy to jump into becoming the savior role. But the thing that Johara realized, and I'm so glad, and I pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and I thank Allah that she did, was that you have to start taking care of you first. You can't be taking care of other people assuming someone else is going to take care of you. So she really started to embody that and live that.
Like, the biggest thing that happened when I came to recall everything, and I was in more, like, I was going through a lot more. I knew this time around, like, I couldn't just pretend it's not there. You know, all the time we're pushed to, like, keep going, you know, like, if you're not dead, it's not that serious. That's the culture in which we operate, you know, like, even mental health is always ascribed to, if you're not Maria, like, if you're not really out of the norm or having behavioral, you know, ways that it's manifesting in your life, like, if you're not completely naked running around, something that is not a daily occurrence, then there's no such thing as mental health, which is a big misconception. And I feel like this had made me, like, it was a catalyst for me to be like, whoop, I gotta get an assessment. I gotta find out what's going on with me. And it became like survival mode, but in a way where I was driven to literally improve my well-being so that it doesn't get to a point where I'm back where I was. And I was like, I don't want to be there. Like, I don't want to be in that kind of space where I almost lose myself, like, without thought and without no warning. And they really do tell you it's those smiling people that are laughing that slip out of,
mm-hmm.
like, the people you least expect
that it's just drop. Your strong friend. Yeah, your strong friend.
The people that, happy, like, the last seem... person you think is usually the ones that, boom. And you're like, oh my God, I didn't think they were going through all of that. And the thing was, like, I knew what I was going through. So I was like, you know, I don't care. I don't care if somebody else understands it. I don't care. I don't care if it doesn't make sense. If I'm struggling, I am going to save that energy that I was putting towards not looking like it. Like, there was a lot of energy I put out to not look like I was in physical pain, not look like the aspect of faith that has given me a lot more resilience is, you know, like, a lot, like I knew I could overcome it. Like, yeah. I was like, this is my God written this for me personally. Like, this is the predicaments I've been given because I could pass them.
Nah. And absolutely.
So I thought about it, like, okay, this is my baseline. Like, this is what I'm working for. If it was given maybe one person down, it would not have worked. But I was like, God gives everybody their baseline that they could pass. Like,
they could pass. And they have the capabilities and the tools and the resources to pass them. Yeah.
Yes, I'm struggling, but I'm like, it's not for free. Like,
that's beautifully said. It's not free. Allah counts everything. Everything.
I was like, I really brought me a lot of consoles. I was like, nothing for free. Like, my bank account is rolling, like, with the aspects of, like, if my body's, like, constantly in pain and, like, you know, mm-hmm. Allah's, like, you know, giving expiation for, like, a thorn prick. Like, you know, what about people that have to move day to day and their pain just never stops? And I was like, wow, I said my body's working harder than I am.
When Johara began to advocate for herself, there was a sort of internal celebration for herself. But also, she realized there were so many other mountains that she had to climb. Not only did she have to fight herself and her brain, she had to fight her family. She had to fight her school. She had to fight ableism. She had to fight her work. There was such a huge war that Johara began to fight for herself. When she said she wasn't backing down, she meant it. And we can't tell that entire story in this podcast. So on the 17th of August, 2021, Johara's birthday, Beautiful Light Studios is coming out with a movie. And it's called Invisible. And it talks about Johara's story, her growth, and what happened after she decided to start advocating for herself. I hope I could see you all there. I hope all of you get to see that film and get to really see the nitty and gritty of what it means to be Johara Lula. Thank you so much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wow, incredible. What a beautiful story. Muna, I'm not surprised, Marshall. You're an incredible narrator. And yeah, I'd like to, the episode is brought to you by Beautiful Light Studios. I'd love to give a shout out to Muna Sheikh Umar, who produced this episode as well as narrated. So you guys, just to say, mashallah, every week we have sponsors that donate, alhamdulillah, to these episodes. May Allah increase their mizan. We also recently just launched our Patreon page. You guys, if you are benefiting from these episodes, from this podcast, we need your constant support, inshallah. The cool thing about Patreon is that not only are you donating, but you're also getting like behind the scenes footage. You're getting audio footage that wasn't able to come on was not able to be like in the podcast, but you can listen to them on the Patreon, being a member of our Patreon page, inshallah, and you'll get all that access, all of that, you know, good stuff that I guess everybody else won't be able to get it, but you will, inshallah. So check out our Patreon page. And yeah, it's popping in there, honestly. The footage, the hidden footage, the footage that we didn't get to go are always the best. And it was so hard for Muna to cut off, but I'm so glad that we're able to kind of recuperate them and still share them, inshallah. So join our Patreon membership. And yeah, we're going to be back next week in your ear, in your speaker, telling you a good story.